Even though rock and roll is 25 years old, only a handful of bands have become what can only be called legendary. The Who, in other words, have a very special and unique place in contemporary music. Some say The Who are the greatest performing band in rock. And they came to New York City in September to perform in 7 sold-out nights. The opening night at the small Capitol Theater in Passaic, New Jersey was very exciting. It was the first Who performance in the United States in 3.5 years, and the first time the band performed here since the death of Keith Moon. The conversation with Peter Townsend that you are about to hear took place the next afternoon following opening night, and we first asked Pete for a capsule rundown on the Who's beginnings.
Well, the band began in about 1959-60 at school. With John Entwistle and myself playing together initially. We played Dixieland jazz, that kind of stuff, which was popular at the time. And in England, it was considered to be slightly more real than the kind of pop music that was around at the time, which was a bit vacuous, the kind of Paul Anka kind of stuff. And then we found, or Roger had a group, Roger Daltrey, he was at the same school, and we got a little bit older, and I suppose when I was about 14 or 15, I joined his group with John, and at that time we were called the Detours, and we used to play kind of Duane Eddy kind of rock and roll, that kind of thing, guitar stuff and odd Elvis tunes and that kind of thing, copying other people's music. And we lived in an area of London called Acton, which is near Shepherd's Bush. And there were a couple of other guys in the band. It's not really worth mentioning because the lineup changed all the time. You know, we'd have a guy in one week as to sing. And Roger used to play guitar at that time, lead guitar.
Mm-hmm. And, right, you were what?
I was the rhythm player, rhythm guitar. And about... I think what was the turning point for us, like for a lot of bands, we kept going, we kept playing pubs and stuff like that, and clubs, and used to make some, you know, good money. Bands used to actually make money in those days. And what was the turning point was the Beatles came along. I think that was in 63, late 63. And I was at art school at the time, about 16 or 17. And... just really turned everybody's heads around. It made everybody in Britain realise that British rock and roll meant something and that had something, and we stopped looking to the States all the time. Although, of course, we were taking our roots from American music, from black American music and from Elvis and stuff like that. But mainly, like the Beatles, we became influenced by Tam and Motown and R&B. And I think we reorganised the band into that kind of frame of music, with Roger just singing, me taking over lead guitar, and we found Keith Moon to play drums.
Was Keith in some other band?
Yeah, he was in a band that was playing kind of Beach Boys music called the Beachcombers. And I think about a year after the Beatles came on the scene, we managed to get a recording contract. We lost one recording contract. It's quite an interesting story. We lost one recording contract. We did an audition with the company that were looking after the Beatles. I think it was EMI. And we lost it because we weren't writing our own stuff. They said they were looking for bands that wrote their own material. So I decided to have a bash at it. Otherwise, I don't think I ever would have done. I met John Burgess, the guy who was the A&R man, the other day. I was in a studio and he was there and he said, you know, I feel such a fool for turning down The Who. And I said, well, listen, don't feel a fool, because if you hadn't turned us down on the basis that we didn't write our own material, I would probably never have started to write.
And, of course, you know, Pete Townsend as a writer is as much an influence and impact on rock and roll as Pete Townsend, the guitarist, or the movie producer now.
Oh, God, yeah.
Did you enjoy writing music right off the bat?
I mean, it was magic to actually suddenly find this new vehicle of expression. I mean, I'd have, up to that particular point, the guitar, to me, was what it is to a lot of, you know, ugly kids on the block. It was like a weapon. You know, it was mm-hmm. a way to get recognized mm-hmm. and to, in a sense, to have some power and a way to be recognized and admired by your other kids on the street mm-hmm. and so on, and get a bit of respect without getting involved in street fights, without getting involved in high fashion or disco dancing or any stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty vacuous, obviously, just playing for those reasons. So for me, you know, I considered myself a pretty kind of arty character. You know, I was at art college, as were, funnily enough, a lot of the people around at that mm-hmm. time. A couple of the Beatles went to art school. Mm,
Jagger went to art school.
Jagger, yeah. Mm-hmm. Ray Davies of the Kinks. Quite a few people mm-hmm. from the early R&B scene in Britain were art college bust. And it allowed me to, you know, say things that were inside. We had a manager at that particular time, a guy called Pete Meaden, who was very interested in the mod movement at the time, which is enjoying a big revival at the moment in Britain.
Isn't everything?
Yeah.
We're enjoying a revival, I mean.
Isn't everything?
Yes.
They'll think of something.
I mean, rock and roll wise, it seems like everything is.
Yeah, well, the mod movement mm-hmm. in Britain wasn't just about music. It certainly wasn't about rock and roll. It was about R&B. It was about Town and Motown and stuff like that. And one interesting thing that is happening in the mod revival in Britain at the moment, just to digress for a second, is that they're going back to listening to that kind of music again. And I'm quite interested to see what the evolution now is going to be, roots-wise, you know, for these kids that are mm-hmm. going right back to square one again.
I mean, they're listening to the Four Tops and
uh-huh.
and early
Smokey
Stevie Wonder
and
Smokey
stuff,
Robinson,
yeah.
the old Temptations.
And Jimmy Reed, mm-hmm. Howlin' Wolf, stuff like that. Anyway, it was Can't Explain, Anyway, Anyhow, Anywhere. Then My Generation, of course. And then after that, a string of reasonably successful single hits in Britain for us. Over a period of 2 years, 1965, 1966, we became very well established in Britain very quickly, with good singles success. Albums in those days nobody really took seriously. Despite the fact that the Beatles had shown that you could put together albums of high quality material, we still saw them as, you know, an opportunity to go into the studio and have some fun.
Knock some tunes out.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, didn't you open the show last night with I Can't Explain?
Yeah.
Is that why? Because it's the first real... is there a connection
yeah,
there?
We've just started with it for a long time. Mm-hmm. Let's get there.
Mm-hmm. But it was the first one, and now the show starts with it. And then you do a lot of the early ones at the top of the set. You do My Generation. And,
yeah.
And then get on to some of the newer things from there.
Yeah.
Talking about, you know, everything is a revival now. When the phrase, about a year or so ago, when the phrase punk rock was being knocked around about, a lot of people said, well, the Who were the first punk rock band.
Yeah, I don't think it's really accurate. I think the Stones were the first sort of everything band, in a way. The Beatles were considered to be pretty risque when they first appeared, with dinky haircuts and dinky jackets. But when the Stones came along, I mean, they were the band that hit me fashion-wise and impact-wise. You know, when I first saw them live, we used to support them quite a lot.
When you say support them, you mean play on the same bill with them?
Yeah, mm-hmm. because they came from a similar area. And the Stones really affected me very, very deeply. Their wildness on the stage, the fact that they didn't wear uniforms, this kind of thing was very just outrageous, you know. And Jagger's stage performance and Keith Richards' stage performance, just very, very wild and unkempt. And they were the first, I think the closest to a sort of a latter-day punk mm-hmm. image. But I don't know, you know, how many American kids really know what happened in London with the punk bands. I mean, it was unbelievable It was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, did you go to a concert, for example? Have you ever been to a punk concert in Britain?
No, I haven't. None.
Well, they were crazy. They
You're
were
talking about back in the early 60s now?
No, I'm talking about this recent thing.
Or the recent
thing.
Wave.
Yeah. You know, what I'm saying, really, is to actually compare a band like The Who, you know, at any stage of their career, to what the punks were doing is impossible, really, because the punks were just really total anarchy. The audience and the bands, it was a completely anarchistic, not destructive, it was just completely outrageously free. And of course, The Who's music was never like that. I mean, we used to break up a few instruments and now and again, and we used to play. I mean, particularly Keith's style was very loose and loud, and my style was very heavy. But you know, there were a lot of bands playing that kind of music at the time. The early Kinks were pretty raucous outfit, and the band that Eric used to play with, the Yardbirds. I mean, they were a pretty outrageous outfit as well. I mean, sound-wise.
Do you think that this recent anarchistic punk rock and roll became so popular in England but never really happened in the United States was because the rock and roll generation of a few years ago, the environment they came out of in England was so different from the environment that they came out of the United States? Working-class kids in England as opposed to working-class kids in America.
I think it's a cultural difference, obviously, but I think it's like it's the only music, the only rock music that I've heard for a long, long time, which has got nothing to do with any roots whatsoever.
Do you think that musically it's got some validity?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were some great albums. I mean, my favourite album of the period was the Sex Pistols album, which... was produced by Chris Thomas. That Never Mind the Bollocks is the
first album of theirs.
And I think Pretty Vacant, that track on it, you know, we're so pretty vacant, you know. I think it's like a modern My Generation, really. It's not as obvious as My Generation, but it's the same kind of thing. But the amazing thing was, is that the concerts were so hectic, so violent, and the early, particularly in the first 6 months of the thing, when bands like the Clash and the Vibrators and the Sex Pistols and various... I mean, the Sex Pistols couldn't actually play in public. I mean, it was that bad. They had to play unannounced concerts. Consequently, there's very, very few people who ever saw them appear. I never saw them appear. But I saw several other bands. You know, I used to go to clubs... and stand and get insulted. Just stand there and endure these snotty-nosed little kids coming out and saying, "Boring old fart! Boring old fart!"
Do you think that taking in the whole rock and roll picture, that the music that you're talking about now and the violence turned off so many people that maybe it kind of started to put a nail in the rock and roll coffin?
No, I reckon what happened, why punk went into such a rapid demise, or never ever got going, was precisely because they had no roots. Bands like The Who and The Stones, as I've said before, for fear of repeating myself, I mean, we had very strong roots in R&B, but they were wider than that too. I mean, when I was 17, I used to listen to and try to bring out in my music jazz. I used to listen to Coltrane, Charlie Parker, early Herbie Hancock, people like that. And so we had a very strong... It's like building a mountain and then taking off. Whereas what the punks wanted to do is they wanted to clear everything out of the way. They felt that the establishment, the rock establishment, was too powerful, too gross, that the people that controlled it were too old, too out of touch, that the superstars like The Who and The Stones and Yes and Genesis and people like this were far too...
artsy, maybe.
No, too technocratic. That their concerts were unwieldy and too expensive, and that club performances had practically disappeared. Bands had to pay and still do in Britain, to appear with a major act. They call it tour support. You actually have to pay, if you're a small band and you want to tour with, say, I don't know, an up-and-coming group, or say like The Who, the supporting bands are expected to share the expenses, which, let's face it, are established by the major act, not by the supporting group. I mean, if The Who go on, we take lasers and enormous lighting stacks and 54 road crew, etc., etc., etc. And if somebody wants to tour with us, they're expected not necessarily to pay us for the privilege of of playing, but certainly to share some of the expenses. And I think all these factors, and the fact that it was easy money for the record companies too, to just to sit on their laurels and work with established acts. And it's quite interesting talking to people in the States now, particularly people who are in control of the big record companies, who are saying, listen, there's no recession. There is no record recession. What is actually happening is there's no new music. And we've got to get off our asses and find the new American music.
Do you think that's so?
Well, who's new in America? The Cars and the Knack. And with the greatest respect to two very, very fine bands, they've both been around a long time. You know, I know the guy, I've known the guy in the Knack since he was 16.
So do you think that do you think that rock and roll is in a place now where it has to get some kind of new blood and rejuvenation and new ideas and new thoughts? Do you think it's kind of feeding off itself?
Yeah, I mean, I think perhaps any new or any American musician who's thinking of putting a band together could actually take a lesson, though, from the way that the punks manipulated the press and the record companies. Because it was brilliantly done. But they should also take a lesson from the fact that obviously you can't lay waste to everything and then expect to be able to build from there. You have to build from somewhere, and of course the more you've got behind you, the better. I mean, I'm talking about musical roots, really. Mm-hmm. Because musical evolution is so slow. The Who have been in existence now for 16 years as a performing outfit. And we still go on stage and we play that old stuff, and we still play bits of Tommy, and sometimes people say, oh, you're wallowing in nostalgia. It's not nostalgia for us, it is what we are.
Does it ever get tiresome playing My Generation again, or
now and again,
or Pinball Wizard?
Now and again it feels a bit peculiar to play My Generation.
But you keep rearranging the songs too, don't you?
A little bit, yeah. Not to the extent that somebody like Dylan does it.
Yeah, he totally rewrites them.
Yeah, I don't know how he remembers all the words. I listened to that live album of his, and the words on it, it's about 40,000 million words.
Are you a fan of Bob Dylan?
Yes and no. I think, you know, I think he's done really terrific stuff. I didn't go and see him in his live concerts in Britain because I was afraid.
What do you mean?
I was afraid I was afraid it was going to be terrible. I wasn't going to like it. And my wife went and she really liked it.
I saw that tour. I really liked
it.
This might be a good place, talking about rock and roll roots and music being built on other music, to bring in the few things I want to ask you about this, the subject of disco music. Do you think it has any relationship to rock and roll? Do you think it's another brand? If you saw rock and roll as a tree, let's say, you know, in Motown down there, or blues, or African rhythms, whatever you want the roots of that tree to be, and, you know, and British pop, and psychedelic San Francisco, all these different branches, right? Do you think that disco is another branch on the tree somewhere, or do you think it's a totally separate thing?
I suppose it's a branch on the tree. It depends how you want to deal with it. I know that the longer rock hangs on as a form of expression for musicians and writers, the more it seems to sort of split itself up into factions. I mean, in Britain at the moment there's a heavy metal faction, you know, people that want, you know, old Zeppelin type rock. And there's a band in Britain called AC/DC.
They're getting quite popular in the US.
They played with us on a couple of shows in Europe. I couldn't believe it. I've never seen a band like it in my life. A high energy rock and roll. I mean, if anybody ever gets a chance to see them, they shouldn't miss it. Because they're good. They're like, they wrap up all that early sort of heavy metal stuff, and this guy, the singer, sings a little bit like Paul Rodgers, the guy that used to be in Free and Bad Company. They're a good band, but they don't let up for a second. Not one single slow tune, you know, it's I think disco is music that is designed quite simply for dancing. It's designed for discos, and if you're into discos, and if you're into dancing, you appreciate it. I mean, I love dancing, but I'm not particularly mad on the disco atmosphere. I think disco is music that is designed quite simply for dancing. But I'm not particularly mad on the disco atmosphere. Or that peacock thing. But I mean, there's some terrific records, mm-hmm. I think. You know, I've recently got hold of the Jacksons album with, is it Shake Your Body Down to the Ground? The one that Frank Zappa sartorialized. and I just think it's an amazing record. I mean, the production on it and everything, and I mean it's as a disco album, it's only got like I think two or three danceable tracks. I mean, it's not, but I mean those are the tracks that you hear in a disco. I mean, the Doobie Brothers, a terrific rock and roll band, they've had two tracks which have been heavily played in discos. What a Fool Believes, that track was a European smash in disco.
American smash too in disco.
You know, in every disco in Paris, Berlin, London, they were playing it all the time. It's a beautiful, beautiful record. It just happens to be good to dance to.
Do you have any thoughts about... go ahead, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
No, I said, do you have any thoughts about what this venomous feeling about disco is, this disco sucks movement? Why some rockers, let's call them, feel such hatred toward this music? Do you have any... what is that all about?
You've got to hate something, haven't you? just as long as they only hate the music and not the people behind it, that's okay. I, like a lot of people, got very afraid at one point that the reaction of hard rock fans to disco music had a racist tendency in it, which, you know... I mean, I would have thought anybody would, with a mind or a heart, is going to abhor. But I suppose you've got to live with the fact that that happens occasionally. But I think the real key to it is the fact that when it started, that Philadelphia stuff, that Casey and the Sunshine Band stuff, right, started pouring out of Philadelphia and then it started to spread. It was factory produced music. That's the thing about it. It was well done and everything, but it's got no soul. Like ABBA, wonderful, wonderful records, but Heart of Glass, really, I think. That stuff is factory made. And I think that's what hard rock people really object to, is the fact that it's empty, shallow stuff. And it's produced like breakfast cereal. And it's good, a lot of it, and it's bad, a lot of it, because that's the way everything is in life. But I think it's the emptiness of it which they object to.
You don't think there's an element of people being afraid that rock might be dying and holding on to it and afraid of letting any new kid in on the block? You know what I mean? Like, maybe they're afraid that disco will overtake all of the music and they'll lose their rock and roll.
I suppose it's a possibility. Mm-hmm.
More. I think there's an element of...
But then, you know, if there's a market for something, if there's a need for something, then, you know, form a band. If you want heavy rock, play it. Because, I mean, only about half the Who's act is heavy rock. Probably less than that nowadays. And partly the reason for that isn't because we don't enjoy it. I mean, I could sit and watch AC/DC all night. No question about it. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't play it. I'm 34 years old and my hair's getting thin and I'm not going to stand up on the stage like some 16-year-old kid and run about all night and pretend that I can actually handle it. I can only do so much. And I enjoy all facets of music. And I think our fans respond to that anyway. You know, the people that buy our records, that write to me, don't just write, you know, we love it, you know, when you let loose. I mean, obviously at a concert they like the band to let loose, but they respond to all kinds of stuff, you know, songs like Behind Blue Eyes. Tommy still right. has a big following, and that's not rock and roll. Mm-hmm. No one knows
what it's like. The energy expended on stage, let me throw a recent quote back at you and ask you about it. This is from Record World magazine, quoted you as saying, "The big unasked question is whether Roger Daltrey, John Entwistle, and now Kenny Jones feel they can live without the kind of intense road activity that tradition has stated every rock and roll band needs to survive. What I'm basically saying is that I can't do that. And if The Who really needs that to be a rock and roll band, then I can't be there. But I don't think there's any doubt that as a band in the recording studio, as filmmakers, and as fellow musicians on certain live work, The Who have a positive future." From that, do I take that you'd like to phase out the touring part of The Who?
Well, let's be honest. I mean, we have. We haven't worked in the States since 1976. This is our first concert. We've only done 10 concerts in all since Kenny joined the band. No, I don't want to stop touring altogether, but there are a lot of reasons why I want to keep it short. One is the physical thing, the fact that I'm worried about my health, mainly hearing, because The Who are a little bit quieter now. Funnily enough, as the lineup of the band's got a bit bigger, you know, we've complemented the band, or implemented, or I don't know, whatever you call it. We've got some brass, but most important, we've got a keyboard player, Rabbit, playing with us now. And that helps us to keep the level on the stage down a bit.
Mm-hmm.
The more instruments you get, the quieter you can actually play, funnily enough.
But I did notice last night that you still stand right smack in front of the amplifiers, and I couldn't help but worry just a little bit.
Well, in fact, I've got a big stack there, but I only use half of it.
I see.
It's a half as loud as it used to be. John Entwistle's still very loud, but he has cut down his stuff quite a lot.
Have you been advised medically not to do that anymore?
I've been advised to stop altogether by a hearing guy, but he said obviously that was impossible for me, and that what he would advise me to do was to conserve my hearing. But that's the bit that I find most difficult. It's not, you know, I play on the stage, what, maybe 40 times a year at the most, and if you count up those hours, it's not actually that bad. The where I'm likely to screw up is sticking on a pair of earphones in the middle of the night and listening to music for 5 hours, you know, with the earphones flat out. Or going into a studio and working for, what, 3 months at a stretch, like I have been on my solo album, with a pair of earphones on my head, getting louder and louder and louder. The more I drink, the louder they get. And walking home with an incredible ringing in my ears. But I think, and I think the biggest danger in rock from the hearing point is for the audience. They get the brunt of it. They get a much louder, particularly people sitting in front of stacks. That's why I think it's important to, in bigger halls where you're using massive systems, to fly it, keep it up in the air.
Mm-hmm. Conversation with Peter Townsend, with Pete discussing The Who's feelings about touring.
I think our attitudes in the band have changed a lot. My attitude has changed a lot towards touring, that's why, or towards live performance, that's why I'm here. But I think how can I put it without sounding maudlin about it? I think we suddenly realised that in losing Keith, it's made us realise how much we value one another. And of course, the longer we live and work together, the more important we become to one another, and the more we would feel a gap. If we lost one another. And so we've really agreed, you know, we've agreed on a compromise. It was something, I mean, this was the thing that I was always trying to avoid, was I felt that if a rock and roll band had to tour incessantly to be a rock and roll band, okay, right? But I one thing that a rock and roll band can't do is compromise, I don't think. And I, particularly The Who, I've never ever wanted the band to be compromised. So I felt that, listen, you know, if I want to cut down touring and a rock and roll band can't do it, then I've just got to quit. I didn't want to quit. I didn't want to screw up The Who's career or anything, but I really felt that I had to do it. But I think we've managed to compromise mm-hmm. somehow. We've compromised because we're all going in the same direction and we all feel the same way.
I might point out to younger listeners who might not be aware of it, but before Keith Moon's death, The Who was the only band remaining in rock and roll that was the same band from the beginning to the end. There was never any personnel change, and Kenny Jones now plays drums a part of the band only because of death, but not because of anybody leaving the band.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no other rock and roll band that can say that.
No.
And I think it points out what you're saying about the band caring for one another.
I wonder quite seriously, though, if Keith had lived, whether we would have toured again. Because one thing that helps me get up on stage and enjoy it is the fact that we have now, that there is something different going on. That it is fun to work with a new drummer, a new face, to have somebody different around, and it is great to have a keyboard player and to be able to experiment, and if tomorrow we want to go on with a symphony orchestra, we can sure as hell do it. Because the tradition, the stranglehold, if you like, of the Who cult is gone. It went, Keith very kindly, politely, took it away with him, I think. And I think this is why we carried on, because it allowed us to change. And I mean, we're changing slowly, as always, it's very slow to change. But we are changing, and our music is changing. And obviously, when we go in to do our next album, that's when we'll feel the change the most. Mm-hmm. And we'll see it in the music, obviously. But, so really what it comes down to is a simple thing. There were all these factors. I wanted to spend more time at home with my family. I was worried about my hearing, etc., etc. And I don't really much like travelling all over the world. Mm. I don't like being away from home very much. But all those things aside, the thing really which was stopping me, I think, was the fact that I wasn't enjoying it anymore. I was enjoying the company of the guys in the band, for Christ's sake, and I was enjoying the concerts, but I wasn't enjoying the music. It was all the same old stuff again and again and again. And the longer we went on, the longer we carry on, the more, if you think of The Who's career, recording career, and thank God we haven't made that many albums, but it's like carrying a kit bag. And you never ever, you're like a collector.
Mm-hmm.
You never ever dump anything.
Yeah, because when people walk out of a concert, they say, well, they didn't play this hole, they didn't play that.
And sometimes I just wish we could just dump that old kit bag out of the window and start again.
You're listening to A Conversation with Peter Townsend. We'll have more after this.
Democratic organization is The Who.
I think it's totally democratic. I think that's one of our problems. That's why it's so difficult for us to make decisions. It's democratic to the point that I think the other important thing to say at this point is that probably there's no such thing as democracy, really. Everybody has different kinds of power and uses it in a different kind of way.
But what I mean to say is that if I would say to, let's say, John Entwistle, if I say, John, who's the leader of The Who? Who's the person that guides The Who?
Mm-hmm.
Would he name somebody? Or would he say, well, we all do? And if I said to Kenny Jones, Kenny, who's the leader? Would he say Pete? Would he say Roger?
Well, I think I think in a way, you know, I get tagged occasionally as the leader or the spokesman or whatever. I mean, because over the years I've done the bulk of the interviews and stuff like that. Basically, I think it's basically because I've done the bulk of the writing. Mm. But John is taking over a lot more of the writing. John writes generally, in the past, has like written one or two tracks on the album, but we on each album. But we broke that tradition on Who Are You, mm. and he wrote three songs. And one of the songs that he wrote was one of the finest tracks on the album, Trick of the Light, mm-hmm. really great heavy rock track. So we're hoping that he's going to be able to write a lot more.
Who wrote Had Enough? Is that your song?
No, that's John's.
That's John's, I thought it was John's.
Yeah, it's another really good track.
Great song, it's one of my favourite songs on the album.
Good, it's my favourite track on that album. Favourite track on that album, yeah. So, you know, we're hoping that the status quo, as it were, mm-hmm. changes a little bit. But, I mean, if you do the bulk of the writing, as I have, then it's indisputable that you end up, to some extent, guiding the direction of the group.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say this, then. If, you know, talking about the writing of the songs and the workings of The Who, can you give us an idea of how a typical Who recording session works? Like the dates are set, the studio is booked, and all of that. And are songs written before you ever get to the studio? How does a song come together? How does a session come
together?
Well,
we do. We work. We've always worked roughly the same way. My mentor and the early manager of the group, Kit Lambert, who used to be so invaluable to me when I was learning to write, bought me a tape recording system back in 64 and encouraged me to put my thoughts onto tape and to produce demo tapes, you know, where I play three or four instruments in the Todd Rundgren tradition. And I've been doing that throughout those years. John works in exactly the same way when he writes a song. So we go in with a batch of demos, and now, like so many other musicians, I've got a home studio, and I've had a home studio for a long time with, you know, really quite sophisticated stuff. So when I do a demo tape, if The Who reject it, or if it doesn't suit The Who, I've actually got a tape there which is, in some cases, good enough to be issued as a master if I ever wanted to put it out myself. Or elements of it might even be used by the band.
Mm-hmm. As
was the case with
demos.
Who Are You and Barbara O'Reilly and Won't Get Forward Again, they actually used my demo tape and recorded onto it. Because the synthesizer bits were a bit tricky, basically, and it's like pointless doing them all over again if you've got a good one to start with. And then from that point, Roger and the producer and myself generally would sit down and go through my material. They would do the same with John. And the reason why Roger is so important in this particular area is because he's a singer. He's got to feel the song. So in another way, you could call him the leader of the group. I can write what I like, but if he doesn't want to sing it, there's nothing on earth going to make him sing it. And if he is forced to sing a song for any particular reason that he doesn't feel, he's not going to sing it as well as one that he does. So I obviously try and come up with stuff which I know he's going to get behind and love to do. And then we start recording. Occasionally we write stuff in the studio. This is quite rare. We did it with a song called 515.
Mm-hmm. This has just been released as a single.
Has it?
Yeah. It has.
Another old one.
Mm-hmm. Conversation with Peter Townsend will continue after these words.
You're listening to Dave Herman's
The movies, because it seems an area that you and The Who are getting into more and more and more.
I don't think we've even begun, you know, because the reason that we wanted to get into movies was because we want to, once and for all, we want to get the definitive rock and roll movie made. We want to do, if you like, a Tommy or a Quadrophenia, some story, some package, some concept of some sort, where the first time the public see it is in movie form.
In other words, where the music and the movie are done at the same time.
Done at the same time, they appear at the same time, and the band's input is as musicians, producers, actors, and composers, script writers, and everything. And we're slowly building up enough experience to do this.
The rest of the members of the Who feel the same way as you do about that?
I guess they do, yeah, because I know John, as a writer, actually has written a whole scenario for a film. I've written one or two small scenarios and one big scenario, which I started in 72.
Is that Lifehouse?
Yeah. Which I don't think I'll actually see the light of day, but I mean, it was very, very important for me to do it and develop it. I helped with the script of Quadrophenia. I was involved in the first and second draft. And obviously the Tommy film was an important experience, and Roger is emerging as a... I can't tell you how good his acting is in this film that he's just done. He's done a film called McVicar, which is another Who film production about a criminal. Public Enemy number one in the UK. A guy that... the press built him into this monstrous man, and he was actually... really quite a redeemable guy, and he was a great escaper. He escaped from prison.
Is there music in McVicar?
Yeah.
Who music?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And but not Who songs. The Who are involved in the production of the album and performing on the album. We're starting as soon as we get back. But there's some songs by my friend Billy Nichols, who has written some stuff for Leo Sayer and the Babies and people like that. And Steve Gibbons has written a couple of things. And Russ Ballard, I don't know if...
from Argent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's written a couple of really great songs for it. Quite what we use, and don't you? I've written a couple of things, and John's going to write some stuff. But I saw the film for the first time the other day, and it's sort of rough-cut form. And I suppose walking away from it, the thing that struck me was that after 5 minutes, I forgot that Roger was Roger.
That's the best compliment you
can get. Yeah, exactly. And I just hope that we can hang on to him as a singer, because the guy is obviously a great actor.
Now, are the songs that are going to be on the Peter Townsend solo album, are they songs that were originally brought to The Who but didn't quite materialize?
No.
They're not?
No. What happened, the first solo album per se that I made was a thing called Who Came First, which wasn't really a solo album at all. It was a collection of ideas and songs in demo form that had been released on limited edition records through the Mayer Barber organization, and it didn't sell very much, but it made a lot of money for the charity involved.
So that was the last project, the solo
and
project.
Yeah, so it wasn't really a solo album. I don't think I've ever done one. And in fact, the way that I would define a solo album would be an album on which I get first choice of the material. And so in this particular case, I've actually used two tracks which I wrote for The Who. One is a track called Tough Boys, and the other is a track called... what was the other one I wrote? Gonna Get You. And... when I went into the studio, I thought, screw it, I'm going to use them. You know, I'm going to get first cut at my own material for this. And so that's, it really is my first solo thing. I mean, the thing I did with Ronnie Lane, the Rough Mix album, was as close as I've ever come to a solo album, but that was Who Rejects. All that material had been rejected by the band.
When will the solo album be out, A, and B, what will it be called?
I've got no clue at the moment what to call it, but it's nearly finished. I've been working on it for a couple of months with Chris Thomas producing, who's, I suppose, famous for his work with Wings and Sex Pistols and Roxy Music and Procol Harum and people like that. And I was expecting to actually be working with Glyn Johns, but at the last minute I decided not to do that.
And you're still struggling with the title for it?
Yeah, I think the album will probably come out January.
Oh, not till next year?
No, I was hoping to get it out this year, but my record label, ATCO, I think, I don't know, it's got, you know, these things, there's scheduling and... Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to mention this terrible word, recession, but... the big albums that are coming out are tending to sort of swallow up some of the less obvious hit material, and you know, I'm just leaving it to the record company to do the right thing. It will come out before the next two albums, there's no question about that.
Okay, Pete, thanks very much.
Cheers.
And our friends are here, and they're going back tomorrow, going back home to England, and they call that home, and they have continued through all the tax problems from years before to remain through, and now there's a slight glow on the horizon for Pete Townsend, for Kenny Jones, and for John Entwistle, and all the other people who like to stay home and call it home. And that's kind of nice, too, to know there's a little relief and people are concerned about you who are able to, over a short period of time, in a lifetime, to be able to make income and then what it has been in the past tax-wise and some of the other problems you've had, and you've remained strong through that time to be British subjects. Have been kind of a tough road, right, Pete? Sort of. Oh, he's
gone. Okay, he's gone.
Yeah, he's... all right. Pete's in what we refer to as...
the John.
Temporarily, yeah, the John, right. Now, I think that's really great. I mean, if you have to do it, John, you have to do it. Whatever you do, you have a nice place. You want to remain there. It's your home.
Yeah, yeah. It's, yeah, it really did get close to us, actually, sort of, you know, saying, well, it's not going to work, we're going to have to get out. Yeah. But it's working out great.
Don't the members of Parliament now, haven't they sort of gotten into this, and aren't they really getting kind of aware, hey, why are all these people leaving?
I mean, one party has, yeah. I mean, the other parties don't particularly care. Yes, they're good riddance to bad rubbish, yeah. But it's all... easing up a bit now. Yeah, it's good. I think it's going to be a nice place to live in pretty soon.
Do you have that? You just said it. I mean, the same thing happens there that happens here, right? There are people that are just not interested in contemporary music. Is really? Do they say that? You know, rubbish and all that. You know.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's. It was part of the sort of Labour Party's slogan that, you know, we don't care if pop groups sort of leave the country. If they want to leave the country, then they don't care about the country. And that was the attitude, really, generally.
Wow. Boy, that's really fighting the tide because, you know, looking at... knowing what happens, because I follow British charts and all that, the wide spectrum of people then that they would be dealing with. I mean, not only from new and contemporary stuff and, you know, things referred to as new wave and all that, but all these strengths of Who's and Stones and Led Zeppelins and all the rest of that, that if they can say that, then they must not be aware of what's been going on around them, or economically anyway, dollars generated and what could happen. They could turn that around to good, but it happens here too, though. It's not that, you know, there are some senators, I'm sure, in Washington, some congressmen that don't even have any idea who the hell the Who are, you know, and could care less, too, because they're into whatever else they're into. But if they were able to look and understand and study what the young generation and young adults, I'm not talking about really young people, I'm not talking about teens or anything, I'm talking about young adults, which is really what our audience is, we don't... I think the teens who are listening to this radio station are advanced musically into what's going on. Musicians and people like you, John Entwistle, and you, Kenny Jones, and Pete, and all that. I think they're, you know, they're advanced in that stage. Instead of listening to Donny Osmond, they've gotten into what music is about, their music, and they like it. So, you know, we really don't think of them as teens. I think our average age would probably be, if we took right now everybody listening and say there are a million people at this given moment, they would be 25 or 24 and a half or something, the average age. But they don't stop at 30 anymore. You know, there was a time when at 30 you were supposed to suddenly turn into something. Whatever that's supposed to be that you turn into that you can't.
Take off your oil boots.
We got to get the clothes off again. Let's see if we can get all the ladies in again. All right. Let me get my belt undone here. Let's put on a show. This is not television, so I'm safe. Okay, everybody get a laugh now. Hearty heart.
I need some color.
What were you talking about?
We were talking about taking our clothes off, Pete. But just
same old story.
It's not television, so we figured it's a wasted effort, and besides, it would draw a lot of laughs.
So, you're naked already.
We did get some instant reaction before, because people came around to the window here. We have, that's the other thing we have that we didn't have before this. And if you look beyond, you can see right out to the street. So when it's raining or snowing, we'll know now. And the weatherman will say, it's a beautiful day today, sunshine, and you look out and it's snowing. So we can see that now. It helps. Pete, did you bring a note back?
From explain my absence.
Yes. I asked you a question while you were gone.
I bumped into this bloke called Dennis in the corridor, and he was trying to explain to me sort of what a wonderful person he was, but I didn't buy it. We were talking about Bruce Forsyth. He's an English comedian that's opened a show.
Yes.
And how the critics were a bit down on him. And I was just saying that he went through a very heavy period with his show in, TV show in Britain. That's all? I mean, that's my explanation.
Isn't Bruce extremely popular in Britain?
Yeah, he's a very beloved figure, but mainly as a kind of a quiz show kind of figure. And that's not what he wants to do. He doesn't want to be a quiz show figure. He wants to be a Sammy Davis, Tony Newley kind of guy. And I don't know whether he can do it or not. He's pretty good.
Is he Jewish? He can do it. He can do it.
Has he got one eye?
I think.
Does he drink like a fish?
Could go downhill from now on. Run out of champagne.
He didn't. He didn't get good reviews. You're right. I caught a couple of reviews, and I did not see the show. But then I don't. I think my audience by now knows that one of the reasons why WNEW-FM does not have critics on the air, you know, people who review movies and review concerts, is because I don't really believe in critics, because you, as an individual, have your two eyes, your two ears, and your one mind, and so does everyone else sitting next to you, and what you may dislike or like, I could disagree or agree with you, but I think it's hard for me to understand how one person can set themselves up originally as a critic anyway to be able to be an expert, to tell me or the audience what is a good piece of music or what is a good concert or what is a good performance, you know, because you may like it or may not like it and everyone else may like it. So I have a hard time dealing with experts.
You know,
knowledge is good, but I think experts are...
It goes even further. It goes to the point where people in the record industry, you'll find a guy on the street, he's putting a band together, and he says, listen, give me a hand, I'm getting no help from the record industry. They're not into the kind of music that I'm doing, they don't understand, it might be a little bit too right field or left field or whatever, and unless I just do basic hard rock or disco, they're not going to buy it. This is really... it's a problem across the board. It's very, very difficult to get past the fact that when you go to make a like a record deal, or you go to sell an album or whatever, you're dealing with people's personal taste. You're dealing with the fact that the guy that runs MCA Records, I can mention them because it's our label, right? He's going to have his own taste. He's going to have his own idea of what he thinks is good, and if somebody says to him, listen, you may not like this, but it's going to be very, very hot anyway, all of a sudden, isn't he being slightly hypocritical? He's got to really run the company true to his own ideals and his own beliefs, and I think critics have got to be the same way. If a critic is honest, then I don't care what they say. But if a critic poses and says something about a concert or about a group because they think they're going to get some kind of kudos from it, then that I don't like. And I think the weird thing is that the kids on the street, the people that buy newspapers, the people that buy Rolling Stone magazine, Cream magazine, any of the magazines that are available, they can spot that critic posing, at least in the rock business, a mile off.
Yes,
and there are people, there are critics and record reviewers that if they say this record is rubbish, I don't buy it. But there are other record reviewers that when they say this record is rubbish, I go right out and buy it. Because I know that it's got to be a good record if this guy says it's bad.
Yeah.
It's a sixth sense.
That's but why really we don't have anybody. So maybe it's better, you know, to let... Okay, when we play something brand new here...
At least you can play the records on the air.
Then you get to listen and say, I like that, and I'm going to go investigate the album, listen to it, and I'm going to buy it, or I'm not going to buy it, or I don't like it, or I do like it. But that's one of the things we do. Our guests are John Entwistle, Pete Townsend, and Kenny Jones. We'll be right back after the news at WNEW-FM in New York. Scott Meany back with you here at WNEW-FM in New York. We are at 8 minutes after 5 o'clock. Our guests are Pete Townsend, John Entwistle, and Kenny Jones. Pete, we are back again on radio. We've done our news and found out the good, the bad, and the indifferent part of that. And just a word, because I think that it's very important at this time with all of us who've been friends all these years to have everybody know about Kenny. And I think the people who accept Kenny, will accept Ken as I have, just in meeting him, through friendship with Keith. I mean, I think everybody who loved Keith for whatever reasons and accepted him as a member of The Who and know now that Keith is gone to the alternative is No Who or No Group or anything else and all that. And I think your choice was excellent. And I know that it wasn't easy. And the many things that go on in the mind and the things that we talked about the last time that we were all discussing the group and the future plans of the group, that it was difficult, but at the same time, maybe Kenny can make things very easy, you know. Yeah. We were just talking about you, Ken, really, and things in the past, what was and what is and what will be. And that's what has to be. And Peter, I know you well enough to know, sensitive as you are, about everything, what you went through and the different things and how people at that given moment, everybody in the world, the press and everybody, hounded you, hounded John, Roger and everything, what went on and everything. And the public's very sensitive too, in their own way. But people who love The Who, whether it was at the Opera House when you did Tommy, whether it was when you were in the park, whether at the garden, all the different things the group has done here and everywhere else, and all the music that you've performed, not to have The Who would be a disaster, you know. So, we're happy to have you back. Glad to know about the movie. Kids are all right now. Quadrophenia coming. More important, you coming in concert in September for 5 nights. And I know your feelings about performing. And if you're going to do it, you want to do it right.
We're doing it right, I reckon. We've done 7 shows so far since we did 7 shows in Europe. And I think that I wouldn't say that they were the greatest shows that any of us have ever played on, but they were great shows, and the band is getting better and better. And I think above everything else now, I mean, like, there's a positive strength that we feel at the moment. I think mostly, the most important of all this is not really taking the band too seriously. This whole thing of like the importance of the Who and stuff like that. We're a band like any other band. There's lots of bands around. There's lots of music. There's lots of people. A lot of people that like the Who like lots of other bands as well. And some folk out there don't give a damn whether we ever play again or not. We're playing now, and if we appear on the stage, it will be because we want to be there, and that's always been something which, has, in a way, what has troubled me in the past about performing has been the fact that the Who has been bigger than itself somehow. It's hard to explain. The old Who, the Who that's embodied in the Kids All Right film, I think is gone now. You know, it's a legend, and it's a nice, safe legend. I don't think you can bury it, and we're quite happy to live with it, but we've got a future, and I think that's really the most important thing to me, and I know it's important to everybody else in the band, that we've got a future to look at, both as musicians and as people. And most of all, just the fact that, you know, I think we all feel very happy and at ease and excited about what we might be able to do. And we're not afraid of failure either. And so with that under our belt, we're really going to go for it on the next album. We hope we're going to start recording in straight after The Garden in September. We're going to go into the studio, and we've got Bill Simsek to produce our next album, and I think that's going to be good new producer for the new band, and I think we've got a lot going for us, you know.
John said something interesting. John, you said that it's so easy for you now, that you feel very at ease with Kenny and all that, and you find yourself able to open up and everything. Is that, you know, you're open, right?
Yeah, Keith's style of playing was very, very difficult to play with. A lot of things that I wanted to do, I couldn't. A lot of things that I play with Kenny now, I hadn't been able to play before. I mean, there's a lot of things I played with Keith that I'm not able to play now, but I feel a lot freer tempo-wise. It's taken. Because Keith was such a flamboyant drummer, such a fluid drummer in a way, it was part of my job to set a tempo.
Part of mine as well.
And now Kenny is responsible for the tempo, and it leaves Pete and myself, you know, freer. I'm not freer.
I agree. It's like I feel freer on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Keith was a great character, but he needed an audience, and that could be draining sometimes. When he was on top, he was wonderful, always wonderful, wonderful guy. I mean, I don't need to say that to anybody that's familiar with The Who, but he had times when anybody that gives 100% of themselves in the way that he did sometimes needs something back. And what was tricky was that for The Who, like last time I spoke to you, I mean, one of the big question marks in my mind was whether or not I personally had the strength to stay in this band.
Yeah, I remember.
That was really what it was about. Was I strong enough to actually keep doing the job? And I think now what's actually happened is Kenny is fresh blood, and we've also got other people working with us. We've got a keyboard player, a guy called Rabbit, who's a Texan. He's worked most of the time in Britain with bands like Paul Kossoff's band Crawler, and he's done a lot of session work with everybody from the Stones right across the board. And he's a great dynamic player, and we hope to maybe incorporate the band with a few horns and everything. But I mean, basically the structure of the band is still the four piece, the heart of the band, and it just, you can't argue with it, you can't debate about it, it just feels right, it feels good, and it, as John says, it feels easier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it feels easier because Kenny has come in and put in 100%, just in the way that Keith put in 100%. Kenny has not put in 50 or 60. It's no conditional. He's come in and he's put his whole body and soul into the band. And it's new, fresh energy, and it's exactly what we needed. And we feel, without getting maudlin about the thing, and I really like to close the subject now, if nobody objects, but in a way, what we all feel is that if there's anything that makes Keith's death livable, it's the fact that we're still here. And I think, you know, that's about it, really, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I think you put it well, Pete, and you too, John.
I'm not.
And now Kenny has been quiet again because he didn't dare talk there. Kenny, what that means is you have a warm welcome, and I know our audience well enough to know that when you come here in September, what your ears will hear is what you would like to hear and the group would like to hear, because first and I think most important is people want to, you know, want the Who back again, and it's been a while since they performed live in New York, and so now in September everybody's going to have that, and you're going to be part of it, and you know, its heaviness, you're aware of it, you know, but at the same time I think you can handle it. We got to keep you out of trouble if possible in New York. But other than that, I think
I'll come stay with you.
Not a lot of no. Don't stay with me. You're in trouble. You got to stay with. I think John is silently, quietly, very strong, and may be able to keep him out of a certain amount of trouble, or share the trouble with him, I think probably, you know. Well, I make sure that Kenny doesn't get in trouble. So, John, it's your job.
You're
now
referring to my hangovers.
To take care of Kenny. Is that it? Did we do? Is he now going to be in charge?
Absolutely hit the nail on the head.
Okay.
John
right.
is the new boss.
All right, but then what the hell are we going to do with Roger? We had all three of you in charge of Roger. Got to make sure he takes care of himself. He is the one missing member. We're talking to members of The Who, Pete Townsend and John Entwistle, and the newest member, Kenny Jones. And we're at WNEW-FM in New York, and we're going to go to a little bit of music from The Kids Are All Right. That's the movie that's around right now, and if you've ever been or to a concert or ever enjoyed their music, you will enjoy the movie. Big Bus from Kids Are All Right. It's a double LP and in line with the movie that's around right now in New York and in New Jersey, Connecticut, Long Island, everywhere. Weather now, brought to you by Emerson Quiet Cool. All the reasons to buy an air conditioner are right there in their name. Tonight, it'll be cloudy, breezy, and turn much cooler after a hot and humid day. The low tonight will be around 60. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, breezy, less humid, high upper 70s. We're at 81 now, and it has been humid, it has been hot. It'll be a little different. And that's nice. So it's 81 now.
The following musical duet will be performed by a violin.
They have an air conditioner, are in their name, Emerson. John Shear presents on the boardwalk, and as you missed it, we have a special live broadcast for you tonight. Around 10 p.m., you can hear Ian Hunter from the Agora Ballroom in Cleveland. A special night. It will be brought to you by 7-Up. They want you to know that America's turning 7-Up. That's Ian Hunter, live from Agora Ballroom in Cleveland. That'll be around 10 p.m. tonight, only here in Metro Media Stereo in New York, WNEW-FM, where rock lives. And it will live again tonight. Ian and his troops will be coming to you live from Cleveland. That'll be around 10 o'clock tonight. In our studios, Pete Townsend and John Entwistle and Kenny Jones, and we're talking about, since maybe you've joined us, it's 25 after 5, recently we will talk first about the movie, which is in your neighborhood. The Kids Are All Right, and that's why they're here. But more importantly, to all of us who love The Who, they'll be here in September for live concerts, 5 of them, count them. If you did send in for those tickets, you should be hearing within 2 weeks or so, in the mail, your tickets, or reject rejection is kind of smarts a little. Comes by mail, right? They'll get their tickets in the mail, or if they didn't quite make it, they won't. But they'll get their checks back in there, certified checks. And better than two, there are five shows now. Pete Townsend, John Entwistle, and new member Kenny Jones. Kenny, I didn't know.
Every time you say that, I'll get younger.
Yeah, I think maybe you're a little worried, Kenny. You seem to think that maybe there's something wrong. There isn't anything wrong at all, and you heard some of the people talking to you. And I think they're waiting. And so when you go on stage at Madison Square Garden in September, I mean, just kick. You know, get out there and do a lot of that, and they're going to love it. And as John and Pete have both said, working with you and all, the group is back together. And most important, everybody else who
lives. What's the same way for me, though?
Well, and listen, one thing that's going to happen is I'm sure you're going to find that it's a nice way to make a living, because people like you, and when you hear people yelling and cheering and applauding, it's a nice way to go. When you're ready, do it right now.
Well, I couldn't have put it better than what you've done.
Don't you want to get on stage right now? Christ, if we had the drums set up for you, you'd do a solo, I know.
If anything, it'll stop me drinking.
John, you're going to do a solo album.
Yeah, starting next month, Los Angeles.
Pete, are you going to do a solo?
Yeah, I start again next month, so I'm doing mine in England. I got Chris Thomas to produce, who's the guy that did Kokomo and the Pretenders, and is probably more famous for the last Wings album. I'm looking forward to it. For a long time, I thought about my first real solo album as being something that I would never ever need to do or want to do, because nothing that I've ever done as a writer has ever been compromised by the Who. It's always been strengthened. But I think there's a space for things that I can do musically on my own, and things that not to say that they're not necessarily out and out rock type ideas, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm really looking forward to doing I'm looking forward in a way to more now to doing this, my solo thing in the next couple of months, because of the fact that I know that right after that we're going to be going into the studio and doing a Who album. And I think just as I enjoyed doing Rough Mix with Ronnie Lane very much, it got me, what's the word, it got me toned up for the Who album. I think in the same way both John and I feel that our solo projects will tone us up for the Who album too.
You feel that way, John?
Yeah.
You have people coming in with you now on the album.
Oh, yeah. Kenny's going to do a bit of the drumming on it, if he can get away.
You're just doing the drumming on my album.
Ah.
Wise, he's got a week with each of us. And Joe Walsh is going to be playing guitar, and Joe Vitale on drums as well.
Right. It's going to be great.
I think that's good. Is Roger, do you know, is he involved in something? Is he going to try to do something solo?
Well, I suppose he's pretty tied up at the moment with the McVicar film. Yeah. And we're hoping that an album will come out of that. Like I said earlier, we've been assembling songs for that for the last year. And we've commissioned material from writers that we really like Billy Nichols, who did some stuff with Leo Sayer. It was a big hit in England. Can't Stop Loving You, it's called. It was a big hit in England. And he's written a few songs for the film. John's written some stuff. I've written some stuff. Steve Gibbons has written a couple of tunes. Russ Ballard, who's a great writer and produced one of Roger's early solo albums, the second one, I think. I was written some stuff, and the story of the story of this guy who was in jail. The interesting part of it is that at one point in his life, he escaped, and he was out of jail for about 2.5 years. And in that 2.5 years that he was out, he actually became rehabilitated. And he rehabilitated through discovering love for the first time in his life. And when you try and put it into words like this, it sounds, you know, maudlin, or it sounds tacky. And that's really the key to this very, very hard lifer who actually found his way back to being a real human being again. And I think music is going to be very important in that story to put it right. And we're hoping that at the end of the film or in some period of the film that not only will Roger star in the thing, obviously, but that also an album will come out at the end which will have some good music on it. We're all going to be performing on that album also.
Billy Nichols wrote some songs, didn't he?
Yeah, right.
It's great.
I said that. Oh. I said the lyrics.
See, it's the champagne.
While you're in your glass, I think.
While you're listening out there at a little after 5:30, we're WNEW-FM in New York, and Pete Townsend is here, and John Entwistle, and the newest member of The Who, Kenny Jones. And we're
getting down to about 6 years old.
Kenny, you know what? First of all, we'll do another thing from Kids Are All Right, and then I'm going to go back. I'm going to let you select something from Small Faces that I think we should play.
We need a dog's delight.
But I will say one thing. The pictures they've used on the cover there is the best of. Definitely was a high school graduate picture thing. Or pre-high school. You didn't change that much. Obviously, Kenny, you've led a clean life.
No, I just look like my mum.
He doesn't look any younger, does he, in this picture?
Oh, you see that?
Look at my hair.
He was born looking like that.
It's funny, isn't it?
You've got a beetle cut.
I have got a beetle cut. And a beetle coat, more or less.
Beetle cut, a beetle coat, polo neck jumper.
Mm.
Hipster trousers.
Yeah.
Suede coat. You're not
I don't
gay,
know what to say.
You,
no, I've actually come through it all right.
You've come through your gay period.
I've come through it. I've definitely not gay.
All right, Kenny, we got to ask you.
There's nothing wrong with being gay.
There's nothing wrong with it.
There's nothing
They're
wrong
wonderful
with it.
Warm human beings.
But Kenny has been through that.
And you should know.
I've been through that phase, yes.
So you've actually been...
No, I haven't been through that phase. I've been through that
phase.
Because
I was wondering about this suede coat on this cover here. The Small Faces.
I gave that to Bob
Small
Fiddler.
Faces.
I did.
Were a great band.
They were, I must confess.
A great band. It's a pity you had to join us and so completely foil their chances of the reunion.
All right, we're all going to get adjourned for a few minutes. We're going to go to Itchy Koo Park, and we'll do whatever we're going to do.
Have a good scratch.
Have a good scratch. Get ourselves busted and arrested and the rest of that. But meanwhile, while you're listening to WNEW-FM, let's go back to that movie that's here now. Mm-hmm. Not the one that's coming in September.
Number six coming
one,
up.
One, two, three, four.
Bring up. Look, it is 5:45. Our guests today, Pete Townsend, John Entwistle, and Kenny Jones. And you've had a lot of fun this afternoon. Got some more time to spend together to talk about things. Kenny, you haven't said a lot, so we're going to call on you to... actually, we had a couple of volunteer drummers and so forth.
It's great to be at WWW.
WWW.
He's carrying over from last night, I can tell that. All right. That's good. We want you in good spirits.
I am.
Let me ask you, I got to ask you and put you on the spot, because they've already been on the spot a long time ago. So, Kenny, your impressions of New York. I mean, you know, you get to go to a lot of places and you've been here before, but I mean,
it hasn't moved.
No, it hasn't.
It's still here. It's just got here quicker.
Would you rather be in London?
No, I'd rather be here.
Back to
because I'm here.
Yeah.
I promise you, I mean it.
To the gas is cheaper.
When I go away, I have to go.
Do you realise you can get a Kiss jacket for $12?
Maybe you're going to pick up a whole bunch, you know?
A Dynasty Tour book for only $4?
In the background, you hear Sister Disco talking.
You can get a group T-shirt in black or tan, adult, small, medium, large, child, small, medium, large. A Bally pinball poster for only $3.50.
Barry, in my bag over there on the right, look in the bag there and you'll see a bumper sticker. It's not a WNEWFM bumper sticker, although we have those now. The first time in our 11 years, we now have bumper stickers and it just says Rock Lives and it says NEWFM.
Have you ever had Kiss in the studio?
Would you like to have this on your bumper on the way home? I mean, honk. This is a sticker that we got, a bumper sticker that says honk if you hate disco. Now, if you were going from, let's say, Manhattan and get on the turnpike and head out somewhere out on the Long Island Expressway, and if you have this on your car, honk if you hate disco, you're going to get honked for a long time all the way out wherever you're going. But it's got to be a little bit of a hassle. I didn't mean to show that or talk about it because I was going to put it on the boss's bumper sticker on his way home.
I'll Kiss a disco group. They are
from now on.
You don't dislike disco, do you, Scott?
Well, yeah, everybody likes whatever they like. I think that disco is something you do when you dance, you know. I don't think it has a hell of a lot to do with music.
Yeah, but I was thinking the other day, I was talking to a wonderful, wonderful lady last night from the MCA disco department, the queen of disco. And MCA, you know, I've got hundreds of disco acts here. Kathy, you know Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a problem. It's a terrible problem. He knows Kathy. and he said so on the air. And she was saying that MCA have got no disco acts at all. And, but she was trying to define it. And I like dancing and I like discotheques because they're clubs. I don't know about Studio 54 or any of that stuff. Or any of the manufactured pulp stuff that comes out of studios, rather than from people, that comes from just, if you like, it's producer's music. But one great record that Doobie Brothers, What a Fool Believes, for example, the Doobie Brothers are a great band, they're a great rock and roll band, and they've made a couple of records that, lately, that have been disco hits, and I like them, and I like dancing to them, and I think if that's a part of disco, then there's nothing wrong with it. Goodbye Sister Disco, or Sister Disco on the last two albums, wasn't an indictment of disco music at all, you know, it was...
No, it was...
I don't want to get caught up in that flack, in a way, you know, I want to make it clear that if it's music and it's good, it passes, as far as I'm concerned, and I don't mind that sort of repetitive beat thing that goes down. I mean, it's...
Disco's happening in London.
I just like to see a bit of excitement in it. A bit more excitement in it.
Do they do in London what they do here? Now, I'm talking about if you go to a disco there and whatever's happening in London, the places that are happening, do you see the people who have been wound up, who've got their routine down, and every single number do exactly the same thing all night long? I think that's kind of, to me, I find that not fun. You know, I would rather go to
the
old-fashioned barn dance or something, you know, where people go under things and go around and you dance and you have a good time or something. But I don't know. Sometimes I think people take the dancing so serious. Yeah.
I don't know. I just think that really when it comes down to it, if somebody wants to do that, and if that's what they enjoy doing, if that's the way they enjoy dancing or whatever, then that's fine. I think the heavy rock fans that say disco sucks, I mean, what they're really doing is they're putting a big line through, all right, a lot of it is trash, but then a lot of heavy rock is trash too.
Mm-hmm.
And all I'm saying is I think they should listen first and then decide. I know that on the radio last night in a car, we were driving along and I was switching through stations and we came switching through stations.
Oh,
and
my
disco,
God.
A disco
I can't
track
believe
came
you
on.
Did it, Pete. Okay.
The rate we came, where
on the radio
was supposed to be there. There was a black bit. They stapled it so
they had fans written on it.
Our transmitter fell apart, right?
And right before you painted your walls. And a disco record came and everybody in the car booed. They didn't give the record a chance, you know. And
well, it was a load of old rubbish, actually. But
rock lives. Rock lives. Rock lives.
God,
disco.
Oh, sorry.
You know, I have that stereo. Not mono.
Okay, hold it, Kenny. We've got Kenny on the spot now. He's been here. We're going to make Kenny a disc jockey. Kenny is going to introduce our next record in whatever way he wants to do. Kenny Jones is going to go back.
Like
he's going to explain all of this to us. All right? You're on the spot. Good. There's
the
microphone.
I'm not saying a word.
Oh, no, you have to do it.
No, I'm not going to do it.
Well, no music then.
No, you do it.
Now they're gonna, they're going to say,
do it,
wait, Kenny.
I'll do it.
All right, good.
Let me do it.
All right.
This next record is...
God, this is terrible.
Ogden's Nut Gone Flake.
Boy.
I don't know what it's like.
It's on. You're on. Now, Kenny Jones introduced that, and that's from that rare collector's album.
It's been remixed. It's horrible. By Andrew Oldham. But that's...
Or a lookalike. That album, that's the round thing in the square jacket. It was the first round.
It was round. It just got put into a square.
Well, no, but I mean, you can see. You know.
Yeah, but that's not the cover. That's a fake.
In Britain, Scott, that album came out as a round jacket.
Oh, it did?
Yeah.
And we got the square round.
You got the square thing because in the States they thought it'd keep rolling off the shelves.
Not going, all right.
It was supposed to look like, in Britain they sell tobacco loose, you know, and you can roll your own cigarettes. They probably do it here too.
It says manufactured by the Small Faces. Is that true, Kenny?
Mm. Yeah, it was manufactured. And Glyn Johns.
Glyn Johns produced that album.
Did you own the media?
He did.
Did you own the media?
I wish I did. No. No, Andrew Oldham did. That's what happened to us.
Andrew Oldham was the manager of the Rolling Stones, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Producer?
Andrew Oldham and Tony Calder.
Entrepreneur.
They were real good for us. I'll tell you, they were great. I can't wait to meet them again.
Tony Calder.
Tony Calder, he's religious now.
Oh, is he?
He's saved himself. And his money. Or my money.
Your money.
I wonder what he's doing with it.
All right, now, John Entwistle, Kenny Jones, and Pete Townsend, we have 3 minutes.
Here's the news.
And then the news, and then Dennis Elsis will be here. And I think, first of all, we ought to tell everybody about Kids Are All Right, the movie that's here, the album that's here in conjunction with the movie, and then more importantly, bring everybody up to date who sent in their mail and their hard-earned dollars for the September concerts. There will be 5 dates for The Who. And at the Garden, it's mail order, and if you didn't send in, there's no chance now, so I'm not going to give you addresses or post office boxes or anything, because those who were listening at the right time are already there. And within 2 weeks, you will know whether you got your tickets, right?
Yeah.
Now I brought us up to date. And then you're going to go in the studio now with Kenny and do a new album sometime in the fall.
Well, we hope it will be released before Christmas this year.
Okay, good.
obviously, we've got, as I said earlier, we've got Bill Simzik to produce, which I think is going to be good for us, because Bill's an old friend.
Who produced the booze, he'll produce the album.
We've known Joe Walsh for a long time, obviously. When we first met Joe, I think it was like 1968, something like that, when the James Gang first began. Bill Simzik was just beginning as a producer then. He produced the early James Gang records, and as now is a big established producer. He produces the Eagles and so on and so forth. But we think he's right for us now, and we're looking forward to doing it. I just wonder who's going to write the material.
The Kids Are All Right, the soundtrack album. Musical director, Mr. John Entwistle, who is sitting to our left. And John, I was talking to the director of the film, Jeff Stein.
Yeah, I want to talk to him as well.
You do, huh? Well, he was telling me that the tapes that you had to work with were like 2-track, maybe 4-track, if you were lucky, and stuff that you had found in the garbage can.
Yeah, a lot of it was on sort of optical, you know, which is like the worst form to deal with music.
Right, that's on the film itself, right?
Yeah, sort of mono-optical. Mm-hmm. And we had to do a lot of transferring to multi-tracks and messing around, yeah.
You got a great sound out of it, really,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are talking about, you know, sort of how many things did we overdub on. And we only did overdubs when it was really necessary, if the film really needed the piece of music, if it was an important piece of footage, you know, then we obviously had to overdub. But most of the time it was bass that had to be overdubbed, because in the 60s and sort of early 70s, no one knew how to record live bass at all.
Right.
And it either came out as raspberries or it wasn't there at all. And in order to use the footage, we had to stick bass on it.
What's the difference between the way bass was recorded then and the way you record it now? I'm sure that you were one of the people who experimented with methods of recording it, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I tried sort of hundreds of different ways of getting my sound onto record, my stage sound, and it was virtually impossible. If you gave an engineer a twangy sound, by the time it got into the control room, he took all the top off and he stuck the bass up and made it sound like a normal bass all the time.
Is it the bottom or the top that they had trouble reading in those days?
They had trouble reading any bass signal at all, you know, unless it was double bass or piano. Yeah, bass guitar suffered all the time.
Was it strictly chance that The Who have so much early film of the band? Was there a design at the time that the band, in the 60s, to actually record everything on film, or was it fortuitous chance?
Well, a lot of it wasn't really recorded on film. A lot of the early stuff that we got in the film was transferred from video, which was a very difficult process, and we managed to get some really good quality transfers done.
Are any of them kinescopes?
What's that?
The early, even before videotape, they had this kinescope method. Everybody looks like they have no teeth.
No.
It's a dark shadows.
I think it was that one, okay. None of them are silent either, yeah.
I didn't mean it that way. Are you pleased with the film? After looking back on it, do you think it's a definitive statement?
I think in some ways it could have been a lot better, but we just couldn't get all of the footage that we wanted. It had either been destroyed by the BBC or disappeared, or it just wasn't available anymore. Yeah. The really steady ghost stuff we got from Mike Lindsay-Hogg's private collection, you know, he had a couple of things on film.
Yeah, some great stuff.
But we tried to remember what television programs we'd done, and most of them have been rubbed off and replaced with like the Weekly Play or something like that.
There were some things. All right, I got some serious questions. You ready for some serious questions? Okay. Do you have as many trumpets as you have guitars?
So. No, I've only got 40 brass instruments, but I've got 131 guitars.
I know, that was an incredible shot. Why so many? You just like to play with the various different sounds?
I'm looking for one I can play, so.
John, how far back does your interest in music extend, just personally?
How do you mean? So how far back in history?
Do you remember actually hearing something or seeing something that inspired you to want to play the guitar or to play any instrument at all?
Well, I was forced to play when I was seven, forced to play the piano by my mother, who played the piano.
And when the relatives came, come on, Johnny, play for the relatives.
Yeah, right. My father played the trumpet. And I was at a holiday camp in England. You know, you have like sort of holiday camps, which are a bit like concentration camps with food.
Right, and matching costumes.
We used to go there every year, you know, for a holiday. And they had this trumpet player in the band, and I liked the sound of the trumpet. You know, I liked the sort of piercing sound of it. So I decided I wanted to take up the trumpet.
That was your first instrument you picked up?
Well, it went piano,
after,
trumpet.
Yeah, right.
And then I realized that the trumpet wasn't loud enough, you know, and there weren't that many trumpet players in rock groups, and I was really getting into rock and roll, so I taught myself the bass.
Were your parents distressed by the musical direction that you took at first?
Not really. They were very proud of me because I played the French horn in a big school's orchestra, you know, and sort of played solos at the local town hall and all that sort of business. But it was when I took up the guitar that they started getting a bit distressed. Yeah.
And then is that pretty much when the band came together? And were you about 15?
We had a band at school. Pete was the rhythm guitarist, and I was the bass player. And then I joined Roger's band. He'd been thrown out of school. Punching a teacher, and I joined his band because it was making money.
And you left Pete behind?
Yeah, and then we threw out the rhythm guitarists, and we brought Pete in on rhythm guitar.
Does it seem to you, John, that the music scene that's happening in the pubs in London now, even the old Railway Pub? I saw some really good bands at the Railway. In fact, Peter's brother's band was playing there the last time I was in London.
Yeah, there's two different types of bands that play in pubs. Well, it's three. I mean, there's the sort of country and western type pub, and there's a sort of pub where old rock musicians go, you know, to play for sort of beer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's pubs where sort of young bands play.
Is that scene, do you think, similar to what was going on when the Who were first pubbing?
Yeah, bands in England usually start off in pubs or fir mountains and stuff like that. Right.
Heard anything lately that has impressed you in any of those situations?
I don't go into pubs. I've got my own in the house.
A lot of people give the Who credit as being the band that kind of started a wave movement or was inspiration.
Well, Peter himself said we're the original punk,
sure.
And if you look at the photographs that they've, in fact, the photographs they've sent out with the promotion material for the film, it looks like a new wave band.
Yeah, I mean the faces were punks in their own way as well.
Yes.
We were Shepherd's Bush punks, and they were East End punks. Yeah.
Was there an intense competition between the Faces and the Who back then? Was it?
Yeah, I mean, only in the press, I think, anyway, because...
You guys are all friends, right?
Oh, yeah.
No, we knew each other, so there wasn't that kind of competition.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it probably did you well to have it in the press. It got both bands publicity.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you know, we were laughing at everything that the press said, you know. Like, we're trying to copy them, and they're trying to copy us, and it was all, you know, you're trying to copy Pete Townsend because he does all the feedback on the guitar, and I'm moving around just like Keith and all that number, you know.
Was there ever a chance in the early days, Kenny, that you might have ended up being in The Who and perhaps Keith would have been in Small Faces? Was it ever that close?
No, because we were... I was from Stepney, from sort of Shepherd's Bush area, sort of. Mm. You know, I thought in those days that Shepherd's Bush was a posh area. Because I'd never been out of the East End.
Don't start one of them, I'm poorer than you ones.
Ah, no, right. Right. So, in fact, the Shepherd's Bush turned out to be just like the East End, which is great, you know.
Now, the movement at that time, I guess, was called mods, wasn't it? Weren't The Who considered, and the Small Faces considered to be mod
bands?
We
were very moddy, yes.
Now, what was a mod?
Someone who wore very bright coloured clothes, trendy sort of person.
Like John.
You know, like John.
Hmm.
Maybe. Yeah, I was starting off as a rocker.
at the flea market film festival a week ago, they had some early films, and one of the early films was The Small Faces. I guess it was a promo film.
Yeah.
And the clothing was, I think you were wearing a hat, and Steve Marriott was wearing a great fur coat of some kind.
Yeah, I think it's around about the Ichiku Park time, I think.
Yeah, just before or just after.
Yeah. Or yeah. Tin Soldier.
Was that considered mod?
Yeah. You know, I mean, well, that was sort of bordering on out the mod stuff into the flower power sort of thing, you know.
Mm.
Yeah, the mod thing didn't last that long, you know. It was a sort of a vehicle to sort of, you know, we found our own pigeonhole. We said both groups said we were mod groups, and our following was from the mod cult. But then as the mod started to die out, I mean, I don't know what the Faces did, but I mean, the Who jumped into sort of
rock
pop art. Pop art and stuff like that, you know, wearing Union Jack jackets and stuff.
The other side of the mod thing was the rockers, right? It was the mods and the rockers.
Yeah.
And were the Beatles and Stones rockers then?
The Beatles, in fact, started out as rockers, really. Because if you see the early pictures of them...
Right, there were no little costumes in the early
ones. Nasty stuff.
Yeah, the groups. I mean, the sort of mods, the rockers, and groups, right? I mean, groups dressed differently from both cults, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They were sort of in between the two. Like the Stones with like leather waistcoats, but, you know, sort of button-down collars and sort of, you know, generally sort of smartened up a bit.
John, did you, when you were all... I guess either of you, actually, because you've both, you know, been in the rock and roll scene now right from the earliest days of the 60s. Did you have any thought at that time of the type of popularity that the Who or the Small Faces on into Faces, etc., were going to gain internationally? Was there an aim to do what the Beatles had done, or...
Not really. I mean, we didn't really have the same sort of adulation as the Beatles, you know, sort of female-wise. I mean, we did in the early days, but then I think both bands realised that in order to exist and to make any money at all, we really had to break in the States and other countries, because you don't earn anything in England, particularly.
What did a band make for an evening's gig at that time?
If you're a big band, I suppose about $600 to $1,000.
For a night.
Mm. We used to make about 600, and then Hendrix came along and stuck his price up, so we had to stick our price up, and ended up, but the only places we could play were universities, which had government grants, you know, for entertainment. So
the United States became a necessity.
Really, yeah, because I mean, with smashing guitars up and stage clothes and, you know, new equipment all the time, we really had to
feed everything.
Start getting out of the red, you know, and we were about $250,000 in the red each year.
So the live, the things that are in the Live at Leeds album are true facts of a band in bankruptcy.
Yeah, we were actually bankrupt for the first 5 years anyway.
So the stories aren't true where Peter used to run into a guitar shop and say, just borrowing it.
he used to steal it, but they used to send him a bill for it. Right?
So then the big thing was to hit America. Was this did you have a specific laid out plan? Okay, this is going to be our attack on America. This is how we're going to have to go.
No, I mean, our plan was to play everywhere so that people could see us, and to keep on playing until people started buying the records. You know.
Hesitation? Were you concerned that maybe it wouldn't happen for you in America?
After about the first six sort of 8 week tours, yeah, we were a bit started to get a bit worried. But
you were supporting Herman's Hermits on the first tour, was that?
Yeah.
Nice film.
Blues McGoos.
Herman's Hermits and The Who.
Yeah.
Or The Who, then Herman's Hermits. Get the audience just warmed up a little.
Well, a lot of the audience went home after we've been on, so.
Not wanting to hear about Mrs. Brown or her lovely daughter.
Or Henry VIII.
That's one thing I do regret, actually, is the Small Faces never, ever came to America.
Never.
Only Faces number two.
Right, with,
you know, Rod and all that.
Right.
By mistake, was it that the Small Faces never showed up?
By bad management, mishandling and stuff like that.
It really was a risk to come to America, because if you came to America, you were neglecting your English fans, and immediately you were giving up success in England.
Mm.
And you really had to take that jump.
I think if we'd have come over here when Edgecombe Park was a hit, it might have been thrown a completely different light on the future of the Small Faces, you know.
Probably.
You know, because we were exhausted from touring around England and Europe and all that.
Well, you've played some dates, right, already?
Yeah.
7 or 8 dates, correct?
No, not 8.
Oh, 7?
7.
Okay.
The first one, which turned into a sort of live rehearsal. We originally wanted to do a complete rehearsal with the lights and the PA system for all the road crew and everyone concerned. So we had a couple of days at the Rainbow booked, and the second night turned into a concert. And it was great because we really wanted to play in front of an audience before we played in front of an audience in Cannes,
mm-hmm.
which, and especially to play to the English people first.
And you know, was it as well received?
Absolutely, you know.
And it's feeling good. The band is like,
yeah,
feeling that.
It was a great relief after the first concert.
I mean,
we'd actually sort of got through it all.
Pete said, when I walked on stage, all the blood left my face. And it didn't come back until I got off stage.
I guess I'm sure that it's a question that's been asked you 100 times since you joined the band, but...
No, I've given up smoking.
I guess... Right. Well, that's it. Next question. I guess the experience of going on that first night with The Who in Keith's place, and given the circumstances of Keith's death, must have perhaps been right up there with the first time that you ever played in front of people in terms of what did your
stomach. Yeah, well, I kept thinking when I went on there, well, I can't let the side down, I can't let Keith down, and also at the same time, I've got to play exactly the way I play and the way I've always played, and sort of struggle for it that way.
Pete made more mistakes than Kenny.
The two of you think Pete was feeling kind of, you know, like a mother hen and very concerned and more concerned about what you're doing?
I think everyone's looking after each other's interests anyway.
Yeah, I think we're all worried for Kenny's sake, but we're all worried about ourselves as well.
Did it seem like a new band for you too that night, John?
Well, we were all pretty unsure. There were about 5 songs that Roger, Pete and myself hadn't played before. And we were just as worried for ourselves as Kenny.
Right? It's strange to hear that. A band like The Who worries about going on stage and
material. We played for about 3.5 years. You know, we'd done the 2 private concerts for the film. And... which were pretty easy going, but
that was
the time before a paying audience. You know.
Yeah, that was exactly the same for me, because the last time I really went on the road properly and did a major tour and all that was with the last tour of The Faces, you know, and then we kind of folded up after that.
And now, of course, you've got America to conquer again.
The proof's in the pudding.
Well,
I mean, we're really, you know, saying on the way here in the car that we really sort of want to play here now, right?
Yeah.
Instead of...
Well, that's kind of stuff.
So. Got a guitar?
Can you sing? Yeah, we haven't got a singer.
Nir has been scuffling around town and come up with Kenny's single here.
Whoa.
This
ready or not?
The Kenny Jones single.
Now, this is a Jackson Brown tune. How the heck did you pick up on a Jackson Brown tune? And could you just give the
I just like the album, and I like the song on the album. And at that stage, I was thinking, well, I'd like to do something else apart from just playing drums, just to prove to myself that I could actually do something else. You know? So I'd never sung before in midlife, and I just took the bull by the horns and went into the studio and did it. I regret about doing that record is leaving out one of the verses, you know, the best verse, because I was told by my brother-in-law who produced it, we have to keep it short, it's going to be a single.
Being in The Who, being in The Who is a whole lot different than being in most rock and roll bands. The Who are more than stars, they're traditions. Each of you is a tradition, I think, to the people who collect your records. And who've been listening and following the band right from the start.
Anybody that's into rock and roll, really.
Has this
Has this the reality of this position seems to me something that you people deal with better than a lot of bands have been able to. It's destroyed a lot of bands.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I think it's mainly that I don't have to live up to being John Entwistle because I am John Entwistle, and I know who I am, and it's
well, he said it. Yeah, that's basically it.
You know, the kids are all right.
Yeah, it's a very much a people's band as well, you know.
Yeah.
The people's band.
It's people's band. For the people. By the people. You're crazy.
Everyone always got the feeling that the Who get dirty. You know, it's not they just go up there in clean white costumes and play, and that's that. It's regular folks who live hard.
Yeah, we get covered in wine stains.
Yeah, right.
Yes. And the stories are true. The cattle, the cars, and the swimming pools, and the hotel rooms that look like tornadoes have blown through.
The car in the swimming pool isn't quite true. It was a pond. Yeah.
No.
A pond in the swimming pool.
But yet there is a hotel in New York where you guys are always welcome with open arms, correct?
No, they throw that down.
Hotel.
Yeah, we're not staying there this time. No.
Oh, okay.
They're building. No, they're not. We're not going to mention the name.
They're building one right next door to us here. That great big hole isn't the way a hotel ended up after the hole. That's the way a hotel looks before it starts. Another film coming out, too, don't you, besides this one?
Yeah, Quadrophenia.
When's
that's,
that?
That's around about September, October, I think.
A lot of action going on. You're doing a tour. You're doing another film. You have a film out. Why all of a sudden the renewed energy?
We spent the last 3 years more or less preparing for this time. You know, it took about a year to do the Kids Are All Right film. It took about six or seven months to do Quadrophenia, and after Keith died, and we decided to carry on, we realized that we were going to have to tour, not quite extensively, but to show our faces everywhere, so that the two films didn't become an epitaph, to prove to everybody that the Who still existed and we were going to carry on. So we've had to work harder, after we've done all the work on the films. Now we've got to work even harder to sort of let the new group show through.
It sounds like the decision to carry on was not as difficult a decision as one might have thought, given those reasons that you've just stated.
No, I mean we had a meeting soon after it happened, and up to then, we'd all been saying to each other, well, if one of us dies or one of us leaves, then it'll be the end of the Who. We'll have to break up and go our own separate ways. And then when it happened, we realized that it was important to us that the Who did carry on. And it's hard work, It's hard work.
Do you have any specific plans for the future, perhaps some more solo material or another Who album?
Well, both really. Pete's started another solo album. I start my next solo album in about 8 days' time in Los Angeles. And we go into the studio with The Who November, October.
You are going to be doing some new material on a tour, is that correct?
Or not? Well, on the Garden Date tour.
Right.
If we get a chance to have a nice rehearsal.
Yeah. You can use my house. Kenny, are you comfortable now as a member of The Who?
Yeah, I was from...
We bought him a new drumstick.
I was from the word go anyway, as far as friendship and people are concerned. So that was basically... problem was gone really to begin with. I mean, the only problem I had was learning the numbers because I'd never learned a complete stage act before.
Luckily, there's the Who by numbers, and that makes it possible for you to.
I didn't listen to any of the records because I just didn't want to be influenced. I just wanted to continue to play the way I've always played.
Yeah, we had to play the records so that we remembered them.
That's right. Well, I figured I'd wait for that.
Do the tunes sound different at all to you, John?
Very subtly. I mean, obviously the drum parts are completely different, but in a way, it's with Kenny sort of playing differently. I mean, Kenny is just as flamboyant in Keith, but he plays a lot stricter tempo. You know, he sets the tempo. You know, which leaves me a lot of freedom, and at least Pete a lot of freedom.
There were many stories circulating, such that you were contemplating adding more people into the band for a tour.
He plays a lot stricter tempo. You know, he sets the tempo. You know, which leaves me a lot of freedom, and at least Pete a lot of freedom.
There were many stories circulating, such that you were contemplating adding more people into the band for a tour, like another guitarist or a keyboardist, perhaps.
Yeah, it's only because we were getting lonely.
Yeah, and you wanted to surround it.
We need a new blood to terrorize.
is there truth to that? Or?
We don't know yet. We're going to try a few things out in rehearsals when we get back together in August. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, then it's the boot.
Okay, the boot, eh? Let's play. Let's finish off here with another cut from the album.
Well, there's one thing I'd like to ask you guys.
Well, go ahead.
Okay.
Just to go on.
I'm sorry to wrap things up, but would you just destroy something here for us so we can end the interview? Because John, I've never seen you break anything.
We're all dressed up. We can't do this. We're all dressed up.
Kenny, you've got to initiate yourself here. Take the microphone.
Who had gathered outside the Coliseum here in Cincinnati with their general admission tickets, ready to get in the stadium, the Coliseum, as fast as they could, so they could get the better places on the floor close to the stage. They were very well behaved. According to the police, it was one of the most well behaved, one of the better behaved rock concert crowds that they've had to deal with. They were having no problems. People weren't tossing bottles. There weren't any fights. It's when the doors open. And the bottom line has to be that not enough doors opened quickly enough to handle the surge of those people. Why they surged that heavily, you know, it's hard to know. There were a lot of people. And when the people in front started falling down, it's a classic stampede situation. The people in back didn't know it. And finally, word filtered back to the police, who were more or less behind the crowd at this point because they were just watching things. They were informed that people are down in front. That's when they headed up. You know, 10 or 15 minutes later, they came across their first body. But the reports are sketchy in terms of how many doors are open. Some are saying 2 out of 50 doors. Not very many. And the problem with the staff trying to get more doors open, but the crowd surged forward too fast for them to get the rest of the doors open, and the rest is in history, as they say. 11 people died. That is the main question. Why? There had to be a problem, because you don't have 11 people trampled to death at every concert that happens in this country. So something was amiss there, whether it was just a strange crowd psychology that got out of hand, or whether there were definitely too many people trying to get through too small of a space.
That's newsman Craig Kopp in Cincinnati. Kenneth Blackwell has been the mayor of Cincinnati since Saturday. He says this won't mean the end of rock and roll arena style in his town.
We're not going to
Reports today that The Who may cancel the rest of their tour. They will, however, appear tonight in Buffalo. The mayor of Providence is already saying that he'll try to cancel the December 17th gig planned for his city. That's the other news. A large number of people from the city plan to make the trip upstate for that show, and in light of last night's tragedy in Cincinnati, they're concerned that it might not go on. The latest reports are that it will. Roger Daltrey says he has mixed emotions about playing tonight, but doesn't think canceling would solve any problems.
I don't see what good it would do. It won't bring anyone back. God knows how we're going to do it. I mean, the last thing in the world I want to do is get on stage and play at the moment. If I do tonight, I'm going to be playing for those 11 kids, that's all I can say.
He's speaking of the 11 people who were killed last night in Cincinnati in an eruption of near riot proportions at the entrance to a Who concert there.
We've heard from the police, we've heard from public officials. Now, for the first time, we're about to hear from the Who. This interview was recorded by Tom Bender, the program director of our sister station in Detroit, at the Pontiac Silverdome, 4 days after the tragic incident in Cincinnati. Here it is.
Hi, I'm Tom Bender. Friday night after the Who performance at the Silverdome, WRIF was fortunate enough to spend some time talking with three members of the Who, Pete Townshend, John Entwistle, and the new drummer, Kenny Jones. What you're about to hear is just kind of a taste of the whole conversation, and we'll mix in some appropriate tunes as well. But with all of the concern about the deaths in Cincinnati, WRIF felt it important to share the band's comments with you tonight. And what I'm sure you'll find by the end of this hour is that the Who rank among the most sensitive and emotional of all rock and rollers. It definitely was my privilege to spend time with them.
Yes, it was difficult for us, and it was difficult for the audience as well, because the audience, the audiences before we got to Detroit were very respectful and laid back. You know, they didn't want us to cause any riots, well. So they sat down, and they stood up at the end of each song, and then sat down again. And it seemed sort of real, sort of hard work to actually get them to get them going. Yeah.
Did you feel like you could let loose tonight, that they were with you?
Tonight, I think tonight was a lot better. Yeah, we felt a lot more at ease. Yeah.
The Sonic was a special show for me, and I think Detroit has always been a special crowd, though, as I said at the Masonic, yeah. We worked, and I don't really want to get too deeply into it. I mean, I think this place that we're playing, that we played tonight, has got possibilities. It's really acceptable in rock and roll is about 15,000 to 20,000, and when you get into 46,000, I think it's a bit of a nonsense. And Pontiac is a case in point. You know, when it's full, it holds 80,000 people, and the kids hate it. They hate it. They don't care who plays it. They'll come. They'll come, they'll pay their money, they'll get in the line and they'll come. But they still hate it. I hate it. The Masonic was great. It was great because it was like you feel close to people. And but then also tonight was great too. Tonight was a much, much better show than we could ever have expected. I mean, I know Cincinnati was a terrible, terrible tragedy. But had it not happened, strangely enough, you know, people could have died tonight. Because when we first played this piss off, I mean, as far as rock concerts go, they should never ever put rock concerts on here. It's not meant for music. We played here when it was just open, and we played to 86,000 kids.
That must have been a horrible experience.
Well, it was like, you know, we talk about a sea of people. And
and you had a small sea tonight down directly in front of you.
Yeah.
Did you feel apprehensive about those folks down there when you looked out? No?
I trusted them, and the security tonight were excellent.
Because
everybody's very conscious at the moment, so it's okay. You mean, you're safe because everybody's alert.
Okay, I remember a whole lot of things in my head from back when, you know, when I was 18, 19. But yet, for somebody, it's still right there for them. There's an umbrella and a timelessness to the music that still makes it very much meaningful for everybody out there, regardless of their age.
The only thing I remember about my generation is that we'd had a string of about 10 hit singles. And everywhere we played, we get screaming girls at the front of the audience. And we used to change the words to my generation to get rid of them, so they wouldn't come back and scream, because we wanted a bit of respect from our audience. And we used to change the name to change the words to ridiculous things.
play that same tune tonight? I mean, that's got to be a massive amount of your life spent playing that one particular tune, for example.
And we try and change it so it's different to play. I mean, the thing that a lot of people don't realize is that every stage show we do, the songs always turn out different. We play off the top of our heads.
We
only rehearse to a certain point, and everything else is just made up on the spot. I mean, I'd say about 15 minutes of the encore was straight off the top of our heads. We hadn't rehearsed it, we didn't know the songs. Pete shouts out the key he's playing, and then we try and like sort of emulate what he's doing.
Who replaced Keith Moon on drums?
No, I feel absolutely comfortable. I feel it's not just staying sort of on the drums within the band. Right? I feel comfortable because I've known everyone for such a long time. Right? So my battle is won. In other words, there is no battle, but I'm just like I feel really at home and at ease. No problem.
It certainly seems that way. It's just like you were all meant for each other, and you fit in. And because I mean, drums are so much a part of the whole show too. I mean, there are certain breaks where you have to be right there. Like you won't get fooled again. You really do key whole new portions of the tune, and it's like they're. It is different. I mean, it is your style, but yet it makes it perfect with the tune.
That's great. So that knocks me out, because if it fits, fantastic, because I haven't changed a single thing. Well, I just play the way I play, and I play with the Who now. I've tried, I've got so many great memories about Detroit, because like the faces, like, this is the place we broke. And
you guys hung out here for months on end.
We loved it. I mean, it was fantastic. And the people in Detroit, I mean, the faces in the Who are one of the same sort of bands in a similar way, but like, and when I say that, I mean, like, we're just down to earth, different plane, but just down to earth people. Now, Detroit is an amazing city of people. I'm not talking about the way it looks or buildings or whether you like the atmosphere of the place or whatever. The people in Detroit are amazing. They are mean, really mean.
As like group and crowd reactions, or just individuals that you've met while you've been here?
Individuals. And crowd reactions. I mean, goes hand in glove.
This is 95.5 WPLJ. Right now we're listening to an interview with three members of The Who, Pete Townsend, John Entwistle, and Kenny Jones.
To Pete Townsend.
It seemed like at Masonic, especially, that you were really firing on all cylinders, and that you felt very rejuvenated. I mean, in comparison to earlier shows, in earlier tours. Do you feel better about this tour?
Well, I went down for a while, I really did. I'm feeling hot now, and I'm feeling happy. I think that's the main thing. I feel happy now. I don't really care whether the shows are good or bad. It's not that I don't care. I don't give a shit. I really want rock. Me and the audience to just like come together somewhere along the line. And I'm not worried about my neuroses or my errors or my problems anymore. I just want to work and do my job and be happy.
Consideration to stopping after hearing the news and stuff.
Well, we didn't know anything about on the day, and as for stopping, period. Listen, I mean, everything in my life tells me to stop. Everything tells me to stop. My wife, my two little girls, my brain, my body. Everything tells me to stop. I'm not going to stop. I'm just not going to
fucked up when I just don't care, really. I really don't care what happens anymore. I mean, I really have gone in blind. I've put the blinkers on and I've gone in and I've done the rock and roll thing and I'm paying and I'm paying and I'm paying. I do not want to stop now. I can't stop now. And I don't even care anymore whether it's right or not. I'm so upset for the kids that died at Cincinnati and for the folks, the parents and the families and all that, but I'm lost in this business. I'm lost in it. You know, I've been in it for 15 years and I can't suddenly switch now. I can't switch. I can't change. I can't change. I don't want to be egoistic, but Who isn't the only band that can cause a stampede? Led Zeppelin can do it, Wings can do it, Yes can do it, Genesis can do it. In fact, at Cincinnati, all those bands did it before we even arrived at it. This rock, it's not the Who, it's rock and roll. It's everybody, it's all of us, we're all bloody responsible, we all make terrible mistakes by indulging our macho instincts. I would hope that perhaps people would react the way we have to this tragedy in Cincinnati and all that, but then I have to be really, really honest. I mean, I can't afford to care too much. I mean, I care. That's not the wrong word. It's not a fault to care. I do care. I care desperately. It's like what rock is about is that we really are on the way to safety. We really are. I mean, all of us. This is not the best time in evolution to be born, to be a kid on the street. I mean, rock and roll is a nice thing to have, to lean on. But it's no harm to that. My job isn't just doing a show. My job is actually speaking to those people and actually reminding them that when they're my age, they can be real. And that's all I really want to do. I just want them to know that it's possible to be happy. And it's possible to go through all that you go through when you're 20, 22, 17, 14. And grow up and still love life and still be on the spot and on the ball and still be able to like make mistakes and still be able to know when you've made a mistake.
It's damn nice to be reminded of those things. And you've done it for us again.
Well, I hope so.
Thank you for the time. I don't want to take any of your time.
There you have it. Behind the scenes and thoughts and feelings of The Who. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I've enjoyed putting it together for you. WRIF sends special thanks to the members of The Who for their time and their thoughts.